This presentation has been prepared by Sipar Shah, LLP, for informational purposes only and is not legal advice. This information is not intended to create, and receipt of it does not constitute, an attorney-client relationship. Participants should not act upon this information without seeking professional counsel. The material discussed during this webinar should not be construed as legal advice or a legal opinion on any facts or circumstances. The content is intended for general information purposes only, and you are urged to consult a lawyer concerning your own situation and any specific legal questions you may have. Any tax information or written tax advice contained herein, including any attachments, is not intended to be and cannot be used by any taxpayer for the purpose of avoiding tax penalties that may be imposed on the taxpayer. Questions can be submitted anytime throughout the presentation via the web conferencing tool. If we do not answer them right away, we will try to address your question after the presentation. For those interested in obtaining CLE credit for this webinar, an attendance verification code will be read during the presentation that will be required on the CLE attendance verification form that will be sent via email immediately after today's presentation. Please write this code down. It will not be reread, and it is required for CLE credit.
Thank you for joining us today on today's webinar. My name is Robert Milligan. I'm one of the panelists on today's webinar, When Trade Secrets Cross International Borders. Our panel today includes myself. I'm a partner in Los Angeles in our trade secrets, non-competes, and computer fraud practice. I'm joined by my partner in the New York office, Marjorie Culver. Her practice is in international labor and employment. And we're also joined by Matt Werber, a senior associate in our Chicago office, in our intellectual property practice. We have an ambitious schedule slated for today's webinar. The topics slated for discussion include a general overview of trade secret and non-compete law in the United States as viewed from a non-U.S. perspective. Matt's going to handle our topic on using the International Trade Commission to address trade secret misappropriation occurring abroad, including a discussion of the recent Federal Circuit decision, the Tian Rui Group. We're also going to discuss drafting considerations for non-disclosure and non-compete agreements from an international perspective, including the effective use of forum selection and choice of law and arbitration provisions. We'll also discuss the latest developments in Europe concerning the use of non-compete and non-disclosure agreements with employees. And throughout our presentation, both myself, Matt, and Marjorie will discuss enforcement mechanisms and remedies, including injunctive relief and obtaining monetary damages. As sort of a high-level overview, our main audience today is foreign-based companies that are doing business in the United States, as well as companies doing business in the United States that may want to become more familiar with trade secret law internationally, as well as within the United States. And one hypo that we will discuss at the end, which kind of gives you a flavor of today's presentation, is a hypothetical of consider a high-level CEO that happens to be living and working in a European country and then joins a direct competitor, and that direct competitor asks that particular employee to go to work in a jurisdiction such as California, where non-compete agreements are typically not enforceable in the typical employment relationship. And so I think what you'll find in today's presentation, that what you'll learn is how that particular hypothetical can be addressed and the various issues and sort of the ways to try to work around that type of situation from the employer's perspective. First, we want to handle an overview of the United States law as it pertains to restrictive covenants and trade secrets. I'll first focus on trade secret law in the United States, and then I'll throw the presentation over to Matt to talk about the recent ITC enforcement actions. So first, with respect to an overview of trade secret law in the United States, general rules of thumb is that non-disclosure, non-compete, non-solicitation of customer and employee provisions are allowed in the majority of states in the United States. There's always certain exceptions, but in general, that's a good rule of thumb. In those jurisdictions that restrictive covenants are allowed, they typically must be reasonable in scope, duration, and geographic limitation. Now, trade secret protection in the United States is based upon statutory law and case law. And 47 states in the United States have adopted some version of the Uniform Trade Secrets Act. The three outliers at this point are Massachusetts, Texas, and New York. They have yet to adopt the Uniform Trade Secrets Act, but they still protect trade secrets through the common law. Now, in addition to the Uniform Trade Secrets Act and common law, the theft of trade secrets is also actionable through criminal enforcement, and the federal government can prosecute violations of trade secret theft under the Economic Espionage Act. Typically, you see that in the news where you have foreign nationals or tangential citizens of the United States that are going to a foreign country and have taken trade secrets. They're more of your high-profile type actions involving trade secrets that are near and dear to national security. Some tangential statutes that invoke, you know, certain trade secret protections and principles under the federal law, there's a Computer Fraud and Abuse Act that in some jurisdictions, it's permitted to use in a lawsuit against employees that steal data, whether that data rises to the level of a trade secret or not. Some jurisdictions only allow that Computer Fraud and Abuse Act to be used in a hacker third-party situation and don't typically allow it in connection with employees that may steal data. And some states have similar type statutes in dealing with misuse of computer resources. Now, with respect to the Uniform Trade Secrets Act, as I indicated, 47 states have adopted it, but that's not to say that they've adopted the same version of the Uniform Trade Secret Act. There are significant differences amongst the different states about what particular version of the Uniform Trade Secrets Act that they adopted. And as I mentioned, even in those states where they've adopted the Uniform Trade Secrets Act, they still rely upon common law that is found in the Restatement of Torts, as well as the Restatement of Unfair Competition. It's important in understanding trade secret law in an individual state in the United States to have a handle on the general case law construing the Uniform Trade Secret Statute in each state. Under the statute itself, in general, there are a wealth of remedies provided to a plaintiff who brings a trade secret claim and is successful, including injunctive relief that can be brought by way of a temporary restraining order or through a preliminary injunction, and an outcome, if the trade secret plaintiff is successful, is possibly getting a permanent injunction. Other remedies include lost profits, unjust enrichment, and a reasonable royalty. There's a concept in U.S. trade secret law called the Inevitable Disclosure Doctrine, and that essentially stands for the proposition that a high-level person has been exposed to the trade secrets of an employer that for them to go to a direct competitor, that they would inevitably disclose those trade secrets, particularly if they were working in the same type of position. Some states follow the Inevitable Disclosure Doctrine. Other states, such as California, do not follow the Inevitable Disclosure Doctrine. As far as other remedies that are available, exemplary damages, which are akin to punitive damages, as well as attorney's fees are available. The statute of limitation is generally 3 years. Some states are unique in the sense that they'll give you 5 years for a trade secret misappropriation claim. And the whole purpose of the Uniform Trade Secret Act was to provide some uniformity to various common law theories regarding the theft of trade secrets. And what the statute provides is a preemption provision. Now, different states have construed that preemption provision differently and adopted different iterations of the preemption provision. What that means in a nutshell is that if the underlying gist of the lawsuit is a trade secret theft claim, the theft of trade secret information, and you want to bring common law claims such as conversion or tortious interference with contractual relations or unfair competition, you may be subject to a preemption argument and not be able to assert that trade secret claim. for our international audience, it's very important to point out that when you initiate a civil lawsuit in the United States, discovery is generally permitted, unlike some civil non-U.S. jurisdictions. Discovery is generally permitted, and it allows the plaintiff to obtain evidence that would further support their claims. In some particular U.S. states, you are required to identify your trade secret with particularity before you can embark on discovery, and that is a requirement in California and some other states, and that can be an obstacle for pursuing your trade secret claim if you're not able to articulate what exactly it is that the other side stole with a sufficient amount of particularity. By way of an example of an adoption of the trade secret, the Uniform Trade Secret Act, the California's version of the Uniform Trade Secret Act, which is known as CUTSA, they define trade secret as information, including a formula, pattern, compilation, program, device, method, technique, or process. And then that particular trade secret has to derive independent economic value, actual or potential, from not being known to the public or to other persons who can obtain economic value from its disclosure and use. All of that is required in order to have a trade secret. And then also, the trade secret owner needs to show that the trade secret was subject to efforts of that are reasonable under the circumstances to maintain its secrecy. And that's important because it's up to the trade secret owner to show that it has adopted measures to protect that trade secret and that those particular measures are reasonable under the circumstances. So the common concept of a trade secret across the United States, it's typically confidential business information that's not generally known, and it's actual or potential. So research, typical research and development, even if it's not actually out there being used in the marketplace yet, it can be protected, and that's where it's important to point out that it's not just actual, it's potential. The other common concept is that the trade secret has to have independent economic value, provide the owner of the trade secret a competitive advantage, and then, as we discussed, there has to be efforts to maintain the secrecy of the information. If it's been publicly disclosed, you're going to have a hard time maintaining that you actually have a trade secret. And so it's important when analyzing trade secret law to look at the individual statute that's been adopted in the state, as well as the case law, in order to figure out what the particular requirements are to assert a trade secret claim and what a potential trade secret lawsuit is going to look like. Are you going to need to identify your trade secrets before discovery is commenced? Are you going to be able to obtain injunctive relief, and what are the requirements for getting injunctive relief in that particular jurisdiction? Is it a particular state that has adopted the inevitable disclosure doctrine? These are all things that need to be considered on a state-by-state basis. The next slide provides some examples of what trade secrets are, and what these are all examples of where courts in the United States have found that this particular information is trade secret. I mean, it has to be taken with a grain of salt, because there's cases where this particular type of information has also found not to be a trade secret, either because there was not reasonable secrecy measures, or that they didn't show that, you know, there was independent economic value. So some examples: trade secrets, customer lists, databases, strategic plans, profit margins, all different types of examples of what trade secrets are. And where does one find a trade secret? You can find a trade secret virtually anywhere. If you find it on the internet, then you may not have a trade secret, because that would denote that it has probably been publicly disclosed. But you typically find a trade secret in, obviously, computer files, drawings, databases, the developmental process of a particular product, whiteboards, Rolodex, emails, and in one's head, that's often a naughty sort of topic, because an employee says, well, I can't turn off my brain and not disclose particular information, but there is case law out there that says, you know, information that's in someone's head can be a trade secret, and that's obviously comes up in the customer sales context, where a sales representative may know certain confidential information of a employer that would enable them to easily flip the business if they were to join a competitor, such as pricing margins, you know, preferences, history, that would allow them to flip the business. And if they're successful in flipping the business, it's not beyond the realm of possibility that you could assert a claim for trade secret misappropriation based upon the use of their trade secrets in their head. Obviously, you're going to have to establish that either through direct or circumstantial evidence in the case. Wanted to just provide sort of a high-level overview of some latest developments in trade secret law in the United States. Obviously, social media is exploding on the scene, and it's become a challenge for trade secret claims with the explosion of LinkedIn and Facebook. More and more customer information, proprietary information that in the past people may have considered, you know, part of their customer list or otherwise proprietary to the company, is now being, you know, placed in places like LinkedIn and Facebook and Twitter, and just the immediacy of information being available and being available on a large level and allowing it to be disclosed to millions and millions of people in the touch of a keyboard or in the click of a mouse has sort of been a game changer in the trade secret world, and has encouraged companies, employers, to be very careful on what particular trade secret information that they give their employees access to. There's a case that's being followed real closely with respect to the ownership of a Twitter account. Particular employee was responsible for adding followers to a Twitter account when they were working for their employer. When he left, he took the account's follower list with him and the password, and there's presently a case in San Francisco, California, in a federal court about whether or not the account's follower list and password could be considered a trade secret. Now, it seems that it may be somewhat of a specious claim, but at least at the pleading stage, the court was willing to allow the case to go forward, and was essentially inviting the defendant to bring a summary judgment motion to challenge whether this information, the follower list and the password, would actually be a trade secret. But we expect to see more cases in this area as more and more information is being put in the cloud and into social media, and whether or not once it's placed in a storage facility outside the company, whether you can still protect the information, particularly where the information is being shared with third parties, where there may not be non-disclosure provisions in place with those third parties. Matt's going to cover the Tian Rui case, but that's another big development in trade secret law in the United States. And in that particular case, the International Trade Commission was essentially given authority to investigate and grant relief against products that are manufactured abroad using misappropriated trade secrets. And the upshot of that particular decision is that it allows U.S. intellectual property rights holders, including the owners of trade secret, to attempt to seal the borders through U.S. customs. So if your trade secrets have been stolen and are being used by foreign nationals, foreign companies, it allows you a mechanism to prevent those trade secrets, those products using your trade secrets from entering the United States. Another big development in trade secret law in the United States generally has been the recent adoption of the America Invents Act. Now, that's the new Patent Act, and you may ask, well, what does that have to do with trade secrets? Many pundits and legal commentators believe that it may lead to more and more companies using trade secret protections as opposed to patent protections in the future, and that's because the America Invents Act will now extend the prior commercial use defense to patent infringement from business method patents to patents for processes, machines, manufacturers, and compositions of matter issued after September 16, 2011. So essentially, if you're able to show that you were using that particular information as a trade secret, you may have a defense to patent infringement. There's obviously a lot of requirements in order to avail yourself of the use of this prior commercial use defense, including that the use has to be between the earlier of 1 year before the effective filing date of the patent application or public disclosure by the patentee. The defendant must also show that the invention or process was in good faith commercially used in the United States, either in an internal commercial use, in an actual arm's length sale, or other transfer that resulted in a commercial use. There are also some other exceptions to the use of this defense, but many believe that this may lead to an explosion of certain companies in certain industries, including pharmaceuticals, of using trade secret protection instead of patent protection, and certainly being able to use it as a defense to patent infringement as the United States changes its patent model to a one that's more similar to some of the European countries. And then just, I don't want to hog all the time here, so just to give you some ideas, a high-level perspective on what generally companies in the United States do to protect their trade secrets and to demonstrate that they have a trade secret based upon reasonable secrecy measures. And remember, that's the key part of the trade secret definition that the company needs to show in order to show that they have a trade secret. And if you don't have reasonable secrecy measures, even if you satisfy all the other requirements of a trade secret, you're not going to have a trade secret. So these next couple of slides are sort of a high-level overview of what companies should be doing in order to protect their trade secrets and say that they actually have trade secrets. Number one, confidentiality agreements. Are those that have access to your trade secrets asked to sign confidentiality agreements? There was a recent study that said in the cases where trade secret plaintiffs are successful, the number one prediction of whether they're successful is whether or not they had confidentiality agreements in place. So that's essential. Other key things is, does the company restrict access to trade secret on a need-to-know basis? Does everybody in the company have access to the trade secrets, or has there been a thoughtful, reasoned approach to give access to those who generally need to know? Does the company mark documents as confidential? Does the company impose discipline or sue for breaches of confidentiality? And does the company ensure that trade secrets are protected throughout the production and distribution process? That's the key situation where the company's done everything right. They've asked their employees, their independent contractors to sign non-disclosure agreements, but then when they send off the information to a third party, maybe it's a supplier or a distributor, and they're sharing that technology, there's no NDA in place. There's no non-disclosure agreement in place. And that's where, you know, it needs to be, the protection of the information needs to be followed all the way through, all the way through as the product gets its way to the marketplace. Some other best practices to show reasonable secrecy measures comes up in the hiring process. Careful screening of candidates and making sure that you review their post-termination restrictive covenants in advance of hire. The red flag is the employer that doesn't want to know what baggage a particular employee is bringing. That's a surefire way for the company to get sued for tortious interference with the non-compete agreement or the trade secret non-disclosure agreement of a of an employee. Another key concept is that the company should make sure that they have, you know, non-disclosure agreements with the company, with the employees, but also within their non-disclosure agreements, make sure they have a provision that acknowledges that they expect the employee to respect the lawful rights of their former employers. So essentially, don't use your former employer's trade secrets in your work with us. Also, as part of the onboarding process of new employees, you want to make sure that the employees sign computer use policies that allow the company to maintain the security of its information, policies with respect to the use of electronic devices such as, you know, digital phones and thumb drives, and also to the extent allowed, make sure that there's that allows the company to do monitoring of the employee's activities on their computer network. So in a nutshell, before I turn it over to Matt, just some high-level recommendations. Companies definitely need to be looking at their computer data and physical security protections. That's particularly important where in those jurisdictions where the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act may not be available for the company. So if they're a little bit uneasy about whether the information that the employee took would rise to the level of a trade secret, they need to make sure that regardless of whether they would be able to bring a Computer Fraud and Abuse Act claim or not, that they've really done a thoughtful process of limiting the data that they apply to their employee, that they allow their employees to have access to. So if some rogue employee takes data, they have a handle that that employee, they know what that employee took, and they didn't necessarily have access to the keys to the kingdom. Encryption is key with respect to maintaining the security of company data, and it's important that if there is a breach of the data, that the company takes immediate action. As I mentioned, monitoring of employees' activities on their computer networks is often essential and very important, especially when you're doing a trade secret investigation. Now, there's limits on what companies can do outside the United States and candidly within the United States, so it's important to know your jurisdiction when it comes to monitoring. We talk a little bit about hiring process, exit process of employees is essential too. It can be an opportunity for the company to see if they have a potential issue with an employee that's leaving to go to a competitor. And that's an opportunity to get the agreement in front of the employee, see if they acknowledge that they're going to honor the agreement, see if they've, you know, returned all company property. It's often a good time. It's often a good opportunity when talking about your trade secret protections and your agreements they have with employees and with third parties to have counsel take a look at those and take a look at not only your agreements but the policies and your procedures that you have in place to protect trade secrets. I'm going to throw the presentation now over to Matt, and he's going to talk about this recent ITC enforcement action. And the upshot of this particular new development is that it's providing companies with a real remedy if they feel that their trade secrets have been stolen and are being used by third parties abroad to keep those products from coming to the United States. So at this point, I'll turn it over to Matt.
Before I begin, to receive CLE credit for this webinar, please write down the following code on the CLE attendance verification form that will be sent via email immediately after today's presentation. Submit the form to the person indicated on that page. The code is SS9215. SS, that's SAMSAM9215. Thank you, Robert. In this part of the presentation, we will explore the issue of what happens when the trade secret misappropriation occurs abroad. Let's look at the scenario above. Company A and Company B have factories in the USA and in China, so they both operate here and abroad. B's factory steals trade secret information from A's factory. So there's misappropriation occurring, but it's all in China. Not in the U.S., but in China. B then uses the trade secret to make products that are shipped to the USA to compete with A's product. Can A seek a remedy? In the patent context, this wouldn't be much of an issue because it's all codified in the patent statute regarding imported products made by a patented process. But here we have a trade secret. And the question is, in the trade secret context, is there relief that A can seek? One option is to go to U.S. state or federal court. Now, there's no question that state and federal courts have the power to enforce trade secrets, yet there are geographic limitations to a court's jurisdiction here, and it may not be possible to enforce a trade secret, particularly when all of the acts of misappropriation, the theft of the information, etc., occurs abroad. Company A can also consider filing suit in China, but A may prefer to litigate here in the USA, particularly if A is an American company or if A would be more comfortable with litigating here. As I will explain, Company A has another option, that is to try to seek relief in the U.S. ITC, also known as the U.S. International Trade Commission. The International Trade Commission is an administrative agency in Washington, D.C. It's all contained within one building in the southwest section of the Beltway, close to the NASA building. They have a lot of responsibilities. They set the import tariff schedules that are used for imports. They're responsible for investigating all types of trade matters that affect U.S. industry. At the request of the United States President and Congress, the U.S. ITC, they prepare trade reports and other opinions. Another thing that they do, which is something a lot of the IP litigators are familiar with, is they investigate trade disputes between private parties, including IP-related trade disputes such as patents, trade secrets, trademarks, copyrights. These types of trade disputes that the ITC investigates, they're also known as Section 337 investigations or Section 337 litigation. As you can see from this graphic here, the ITC has become a very popular litigation forum. Here you can see the numbers are on the rise over the past 10 years since 2002. There was a slight dip in 2009, but overall it's an upward trend. Patent matters are responsible for most of the increase here because the ITC has the power to issue injunctive relief, even if there's no showing of irreparable harm. This is something that's hard to get in a patent matter if you're litigating in federal court because of a Supreme Court decision several years ago regarding irreparable harm in issuing injunctive relief. But again, the ITC, if it finds infringement and a violation in connection with importation, it will issue injunctive relief, which usually involves sealing the border and excluding products. The ITC has also seen some new trade secret matters arrive over the past few years, and that's where we're going to go to the Tian Rui case. And prior to that, I just want to show you the statute. For those of you interested, this is a Section 337 statute. This is the language that relates to trade secret misappropriation. Of course, you will see the word importation there. The ITC's jurisdiction relates to importation. And also, it's important if you're going to be a party that files in the ITC that there be an industry in the United States involved. So those are really the two major requirements that are common in all the different types of Section 337 litigation. If the ITC finds a violation, it will issue something called an exclusion order, which means the ITC directs Customs to stop certain articles at the border. And again, if you're a party that's involved in imports, you got to be careful about what you're doing. You want to avoid the ITC. You don't want to be named in an ITC response, and be careful about what enters the United States. Another interesting thing about the ITC is parties litigate in the ITC. And it almost feels similar to a court proceeding in a lot of ways, but there are no money damages involved. Again, at the end, if a violation is found, what you have is an exclusion order, which, again, excludes products from entering the U.S. An ITC complaint is filed by the IP owner, called the complainant, so it's not called a plaintiff, but a complainant, and the accused party is called a respondent. There's also a third party called some people call it the staff attorney, but there's the commission investigative attorney that looks at issues of public interest. Section 337, the statute, provides for in rem jurisdiction over the imported articles. So you don't necessarily need personal jurisdiction over the respondent. You just need to show that there is importation of certain articles. And again, there's also this domestic industry requirement, which is not surprisingly the subject of intensive litigation. And the requirement differs depending on if it's a patent or a trade secret or a trademark case. Again, the threshold for domestic industry in the ITC is not as high as somebody may think. The complainant doesn't necessarily need a billion-dollar factory on the ground here in the U.S. But again, whether the domestic industry exists, it's litigated heavily in almost every case, and it's really determined on a case-by-case basis. The case law seems to be changing almost every month now. Let's move on to the Tian Rui case. ITC investigations have funny names. It's always called In the Matter of Something, and they always add the product name or the article name. So this is the matter of steel rail whale wheels. And all investigations have a number. This is called the 655 investigation. The main parties are Amstead and Tian Rui. Some people call it the steel rail whale wheel case. So again, just a picture of the product involved. They're not purple. They're made of metal. But again, these are the rail car wheels, the big steel wheels you see on rail cars. It's an interesting case because the ITC exercised its jurisdiction even though the acts of misappropriation occurred entirely in China, as you'll see. Here are the parties. The first party is Amstead Industries. That's the IP, that's the trade secret holder or the complainant. It's an Illinois-based company that makes steel wheels for rail cars. Real quick, you don't need to be a U.S. company to litigate in the ITC. You just need U.S.-based operations. That's why we see Sharp, Samsung, Mitsubishi. A lot of foreign companies litigate in the ITC, but you do need some kind of U.S. presence. So Amstead Industries is an Illinois company. Amstead owns a trade secret manufacturing process. It's called the ABC process. So when I say the ABC process, I also mean the trade secret. And the ABC process, the ABC process is used in the manufacture of these steel wheels, these rail wheels. Amstead has manufacturing facilities here in the U.S., but importantly, Amstead does not perform the ABC process here. The ABC process, they used to perform it here, but at one point they moved the operations to China. That's where they started doing business with this company named Datong. Datong is a licensee of Amstead. Datong licensed the ABC process from Datong. Amstead licensed the ABC process to this Chinese vendor named Datong, and the and Datong used the ABC process to make parts for Amstead, sent them here. Now here comes Tian Rui. Tian Rui is a competitor of Amstead, and that's the accused party here. They understood there was value in this trade secret ABC process and wanted to use it. So at one time, they actually tried to license it from Amstead, but the negotiations failed. So what did they do? They instead went and hired several Datong employees. Again, that's the licensee who knew the ABC process, and they had the employees from Datong bring over Amstead's confidential documents and other information on the ABC process. All of this occurred in China, by the way. Activities occurred between two Chinese facilities. So again, there's no dispute here that misappropriation occurred. The issue, however, again, is that it occurred in China, not in the USA. This case was litigated. It went all the way to trial. In the ITC, it's always a bench trial. It's called an evidentiary hearing. So there's an administrative law judge. And arguments, witnesses, it looks and feels and smells like a bench trial. The administrative law judge, the ALJ, and the commission agreed there was a violation. They agreed that the importation of these wheels violated Section 337. And when the commission finds a violation, the entire line of products are effectively stopped at the border. So it's not a good thing if you want to be in the USA market. You don't want the border sealed for your products if you want to do business here. Let's take a look at what the exclusion order looked like. Here's kind of a basic sampling. The commission issued this exclusion order. It lasts a period of 10 years, so that's a very broad order, and it prohibits the entry of these wheels. There's also a cease and desist order, which applies mostly to operations here. You have to, if you're a respondent and you have an inventory here, you have to get rid of your inventory. You can't sell. You can't transfer or otherwise use these wheels here. You effectively have to ship them out or do something with it, but they no longer can be of use here. So, again, this is a very broad order, and I'm sure it brought down a lot of harm to Tian Rui when this order was issued. real briefly, next slide. Real briefly, I just want to emphasize how quick these investigations occur. This gives you an idea of the timeline. The trial occurred roughly 12 months after the complaint was filed. So we have a complaint filed in August 2008. In August 2009, 12 months later, these parties are litigating at trial. We have a trial. There are also ways in the ITC to seek preliminary relief, too. In that case, you don't even need to wait 12 months. You can be in the ITC almost immediately in a hearing, trying to seek preliminary relief. ITC determinations are appealed to the Federal Circuit. So, Tian Rui took the decision to the Federal Circuit on appeal. And the Federal Circuit reviewed and decided that, lo and behold, the ITC got it right. And again, the ITC rules that the Federal Circuit determined that secrets, you know, held that the secrets in which the acts of misappropriation occurred abroad, they agreed that this appropriation in China occurred all in China, but they still found jurisdiction. And again, the focus is on the importation. The majority panel says the conditions under which products may be imported in the United States, that's where they found jurisdiction. It's the conditions in which you can do the act of importation. The panel's decision regarding domestic industry is also very interesting. They were also asked to decide whether the commission erred by finding that the wheels would injure domestic industry. But again, Onsted is not a domestic manufacturer that's practicing the protected process. Remember, in this case, the ABC process used to be performed by Onsted, but it was since moved to China during the relevant time. So then what's the industry? The panel said the industry is wheels domestically made. The industry is wheels domestically produced by the complainant, even if it's not made using the ABC process. So effectively, Amstead only needed to show that a U.S.-based industry is being threatened. The panel highlighted that there are different requirements depending on whether it's a patent and trademark case or a trade secret case. And they explained that because the Tian Rui wheels could directly compete with wheels domestically produced by the trade secret owner, that's the domestic industry, and there is an injury there or a threat of injury. This decision has given rise to other trade secret matters. For example, a complaint was filed just this past spring in investigation number 337, TA849, and that involves imported rubber resins. Like Tian Rui, the trade secret owner in the 849 investigation raised allegations of misappropriation occurring in China. So we're seeing the same issues again. And most ITC litigators would agree Tian Rui opened the door for these types of matters. Let's take a look at what the dissent had to say in this Federal Circuit decision. Again, the dissent explained that this allows the ITC to bar imports because of acts of unfair competition occurring entirely in China. And again, this is a pretty novel idea in trade secret law. The dissent said, hey, Tian Rui is not a sympathetic litigant. Tian Rui poached employees to take these trade secrets, but still, the dissent was explaining that this happened in China and there should be no reason you should bring this to the U.S. Few lessons learned from this case is, number one, lesson one is be careful of who you do business with. Here's another party, Standard Car Truck Company, or SCT. This is a party I haven't talked about much yet. But SCT agreed to do business with Tian Rui and work with Tian Rui to bring products to the USA. SCT may not have known that the wheels were being produced using a stolen trade secret. Nothing in the decision stated that SCT was guilty of misappropriation, but still, they were named as a respondent, they were dragged into the ITC, they were forced to litigate, and they were named in an exclusion order. So there's an exclusion order out there, 10 years, with SCT's name on it. So your company should take appropriate steps to ensure that its business partners, including the overseas business partners, are acting appropriately. Well, Amstead won. Amstead did win, but still it was a split decision. It was close. And the dissent made another interesting comment. I sympathize with Amstead, and if the bad acts were carried out in the U.S., I would not have hesitated to fine for them. But my sympathy is muted since Amstead had another solution to its problem, obtain a process patent, which leads us to another parting thought. Trade secret owners should also ask your attorneys if it makes sense to at least apply to patent your trade secret. Trade secret rights can evaporate in some instances almost instantly if the trade secret is leaked, but a patent can last 20 years from the date of filing. Of course, you would lose your trade secret status once the application is published or issued, because then it's published to the entire world. But there are ways to keep your application secret. In fact, your application is automatically kept secret for at least 18 months, and it can be kept secret much longer or forever. For example, you can abandon your application if you think it's ultimately not going to lead to a patent. So you have at least 18 months to decide if you want to proceed. You can file, wait 18 months or even longer, and then choose to continue to go for the patent, or you can also abandon the application if you decide you don't want it published. So overall, just understand there are ways to test the patent waters and still maintain your filing date without losing trade secret status. Now we'll turn it over to the next presenter.
Thanks, Matt. This is Robert Milligan. Just wanted to alert everybody, we are running a little bit long. I don't want to shortchange anybody as far as the presentation goes, so we're probably going to run about 5 to 10 minutes long. The webinar is being recorded, so you have to jump away for a meeting or whatnot, feel free to do so, and you'll be getting a electronic copy of the webinar so you can pick up later if need be. Matt brings up a number of fascinating points. I mean, one thing is, why would you bring the ITC action instead of suing in state or federal court? And the answer to that is typically because you may not have personal jurisdiction. The other answer is that you may find that the ITC is a more favorable forum for your particular claim. And then also the wealth of the remedies. I mean, being able to rely upon U.S. customs to exclude products is something that you may not be able to get out of your state or federal court judge. And so that's what's key. The other key thing is to understand from the foreign perspective is that typically your trade secret misappropriation lawsuits arise in state court. And unless there's a diversity jurisdiction, which would allow you to avail yourself of federal court, or if there's some sort of federal claim such as copyright or the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, you're typically going to see your trade secret dispute in state court. And so you may feel that the ITC is a more sophisticated entity to handle your particular dispute. So we want to get to Marjorie about her international non-compete issues. But briefly, we had focused earlier about the nuances of United States trade secret law. And now we just want to focus a little bit on some of the nuances of restrictive covenants and non-competes in the United States, to give everyone a flavor of how things work in the United States. Typically restrictive covenants are used by employers with employees, and they're in addition to your trade secret claims that you would bring. It's essentially a creature of contract, and the purposes for the restrictive covenants are to protect against unfair competition, protect against the use of trade secrets, protect against the solicitation of employees and raiding, and they can help you. If you have customer solicitation, non-solicitation provisions, they can give you some time to repair the customer relationships upon the departure of a key employee, and they can also prevent others from hiring your unique employees. With respect to restrictive covenants, we're talking about non-disclosure, non-solicitation of customers and employees, anti-raiding provisions, and of course, non-competes. Some common considerations with respect to non-competes is that majority of jurisdictions apply a rule of reason, and they're typically can be enforceable so long as they're reasonable in scope, length, and geographical limitation. But it's very important to understand the individual state and see if there's particular local state requirements for non-compete provisions and other restrictive covenants, and we'll briefly get into some of those. Now, some of the the benefits of having restrictive covenants is that you can obtain immediate relief, you can sue for breach, and you can attempt to obtain injunctive relief for violation of the non-compete or other restrictive covenants. And you can also get damages as well for violation of the restrictive covenants. Non-compete lawsuits and trade secret lawsuits, as the audience probably is aware, are not inexpensive, and there's a lot of client time as well as payment to attorney's fees to pursue these actions, but oftentimes companies follow that they are worthwhile to protect their workforce as well as their customer base. With respect to the United States compared to other jurisdictions as it relates to non-competes, in the United States, consideration is required typically for the non-compete and restrictive covenants, but continued employment and employment in some jurisdictions can serve as the consideration for the restrictive covenants. In some U.S. states, employers can still enforce the non-compete even if the employer terminates the employment relationship. And as you'll see from Marjorie's presentation, that's not necessarily the case in other countries. Injunctive relief is typically the top litigation goal in non-compete trade secret litigation, either to prevent the trade secret from being used or to prevent the employee from working for a competitor or soliciting particular customers. Some U.S. states do not generally permit non-competes in the typical employment relationship. Those are California and North Dakota. And we previously discussed about some of the difference in the United States concerning the interpretation of the particular Uniform Trade Secrets Act that was adopted in that jurisdiction. Choice of law and form selection provisions are key in non-compete litigation. Choice of law provisions may be enforceable, but there's always a public policy analysis that is done in determining whether the court where the lawsuit's filed should apply that particular choice of law. And sometimes forum selection provisions can be determinative because a particular court, such as California, may elect not to maintain a non-compete lawsuit on the basis that the employee bargained for a forum selection clause and that particular lawsuit should be take place in a non-California jurisdiction. There are variations among states concerning whether non-competes are binding against successor employers, particularly in acquisition of assets or merger situations. There was a recent Ohio Supreme Court decision that serves as a reminder that you always need to have an assignment provision. In that particular case, there was a merger, and the non-compete agreement did not clearly state that it was assignable, and so in that particular case, the successor was not able to enforce the non-compete. Declaratory relief actions are common in the United States by employees and new employers to invalidate or narrow restrictive covenants. So a new employer that wants to hire an employee and has hired an employee and feels like the former employer's non-compete is invalid, declaratory relief actions to narrow that covenant or invalidate that covenant are quite common. The other key thing is under the full faith and credit clause of the United States Constitution, once a particular state court has weighed in on a non-compete or trade secret situation, that will be binding typically on other states within the United States. Some notable state quirks, as we mentioned, California and North Dakota don't generally allow non-competes in the typical employment situation. The inevitable disclosure doctrine applies in Illinois, Massachusetts, and Pennsylvania. It doesn't apply in California. In Louisiana, a non-compete agreement must be tethered to an individual parish, and if it's not, it's not going to be enforceable. And out-of-state choice of law and forum selection clauses are not enforced in Louisiana. Wisconsin law provides that non-disclosure agreements must be limited in duration. Typically, they're not limited in duration in other states in the typical employment agreement. As we mentioned, Washington State requires independent consideration for new non-disclosure and non-competition agreements. Oregon and New Hampshire require employers to provide an opportunity for employees to review a non-competition agreement prior to the inception of employment. And in Florida, there's a rebuttable presumption that a non-compete of 6 months in duration is reasonable. At this point, I'd like to turn the presentation over to Marjorie, and we do want to, in our our last portion of the presentation, we do want to hit on that hypothetical that we addressed in the beginning of the presentation about the high-level executive who works in a foreign company, a foreign country, and goes to California to try to cleanse themselves of their non-compete. And that's, we're going to throw that out there as some food for thought. But at this point, I'd like to turn it over to Marjorie.
Thank you. So when we consider that employees, you know, in this day and age are very mobile and can basically work just about anywhere if they can get a visa and find someone to sponsor that visa, we have to consider what companies can do to protect their intellectual property when that happens. There's no real easy solution here, but the days of relying on the initial employment agreement that an employee signs under the choice of law where the employee originally worked, those days are gone, and there are a lot of court cases that have reaffirmed that a choice of law is not going to be dispositive about whether or not the future territory where the employee is going to seek to earn their living is going to have a choice in this matter and is going to be able to decide this matter. So what can we do? When we're talking about the potential for employees to go and work elsewhere, it's not everyone. There are certain key executives, key employees that probably have the ability to move elsewhere and move to your competitors that are located elsewhere. We're talking about targeting this group. We're talking about identifying this group and maybe taking a different approach with them than the others, than your other employees, the rank and file, that don't have as much of the keys to the kingdom, if you will. So one size does not fit all. You know, it may be that a company has a stock plan and all of their high-level executives who get restricted stock units or restricted stock have to sign that plan, and in that plan is a non-compete. You will find in many jurisdictions that notwithstanding that non-compete, which is governed by maybe Delaware law where the company is incorporated or New York law where the company is headquartered, that choice of law is going to be problematic when you get to the location where the employee has earned their living and where is currently earning their living. So why is this? It's because just like in the U.S., non-competes are a matter of public policy. For the same reason that California decides that it does not want to enforce non-competes, many other countries take a very hostile approach. And if you're going to try to keep someone who is in the territory from a job, you have to fulfill the requirements of their law when enforcing this. Obviously, as was stated earlier, this can be very time-consuming when you're talking about enforcing a non-compete with a governing law from another country in a new country. Even if it may meet the requirements, you're going to spend some time educating the judge, translating documents. It's not an easy task. There are some chances that you can, with a forum selection clause, an arbitration clause, try to limit the ability of an employee to maybe challenge that in another country. This is a very slim opportunities for this. This is because in most countries, arbitration is not an option when you're talking about an employment matter. It's also, again, a matter of public policy that employees go to labor courts. So having an arbitration clause is not going to, at the end of the day, help you in most countries. A forum selection clause, similarly, especially, and we're focused on Europe a bit here, they have very specific rules about how to determine what is the proper forum for bringing a case. And where the employee works is a very significant determinant of whether or not a court is a proper jurisdiction. Regardless of whether you have a forum selection clause, that may in the end win the day. One thing we'd like to point out is even if your forum selection clause is valid, arbitration clause is valid, you get a judgment or an award, say in the U.S., that award may not give you everything you need in the other country to pursue the employee and prohibit their activities. For example, that award, depending on the country, may only entitle you to damages when you try to get credit for that award, when you try to enter that judgment. You can't get the specific relief that you can if you had initiated an action there. And that's always something to consider, is where might you need to initiate the action. And if you decide to initiate the action in the home forum, is that going to preclude you from getting the relief you want? It's a very important difference to get damages versus injunctive relief. I'm talking about one country in particular, the United Kingdom. Sometimes people have issues with getting the injunctive relief when they have not brought a fresh action. They've tried to enforce a judgment in the that they got in the U.S., and all they can get is damages. So, just mindful of the time here, we'll move on to the next slide. As we said before, it's very important to think about the universe of employees where you might want to take a tailored approach. So what's the solution? You know, the solution is to look at who you need to consider to add extra protections, or kind of a worst case scenario. What happens if this person goes to Switzerland and tries to compete with us there, or goes to Germany where our main competitor is located? And this is the inverse is true as well in our hypothetical. What if you're an operation in Europe and you have a valid non-compete that the person signed in their employment agreement, and they want to go and work for your main competitor that's in California? It's always important to think a few steps ahead about where is likely the breach is likely to occur and where is the main threat of your activity. Obviously, where the work is typically performed is very important, but also think ahead to where are your competitors and where is the person likely to go. And when you think about that and you know the universe of people where that applies, you can actually prepare a non-compete that takes into account the worst case scenario, the potential bad situation where you're going to be trying to enforce this in another country. Drafting to the higher standard of the two will actually, with some foresight, will actually give you more protection and more security in that case. One other thing to keep in mind, again, there's the issue of, okay, our employee may go, may leave Germany, may come to California and try to shake off the non-compete, as we say, but, you know, does that person still have assets in the country they left? Maybe an injunction in California might not be able to be obtained, but if you go to court in Germany and they violated a valid non-compete there and it applies to activity in California, they have a home, they have assets that are still there, there is some leverage that you can use to protect your interests. Again, at the end of the day, the injunction is really what you want, but it's the ability to get some other kind of relief is still important. I'll make a note about, again, our scenario where you have a restricted stock plan and the non-compete is included in that plan. There's a clawback. In some countries, that clawback, regardless of whether or not the non-compete would otherwise meet the local requirements, the clawback is potentially just a forfeiture of money based on contractual considerations. It doesn't prevent them from being employed, and if it's not enforced that way, again, that's another alternative, another backup plan to impose consequences and financial consequences for violating the non-compete. In fact, I'll just note that in Singapore, there was a court case that said that a non-compete that included a clawback, not an injunctive relief type of non-compete. The only consequence was this forfeiture or clawback. That was actually not a restraint of trade. It was just a contractual forfeiture clause. I don't know whether that's the wave of the future, but it certainly is consistent with this approach of finding another way to impose some financial consequences, depending on the type of threat to your business. So let's just, you know, compare it to the U.S. And what we know about the U.S. and the requirements. When you're thinking about drafting and preparing a non-compete to take into account global requirements, I thought I would highlight some of the more common ones. Number one on the list to check is this non-compete when you're considering the global reach of the employee. Does the potential jurisdiction require payment during the non-compete period? This is the first thing to check always. There are a number of countries that require payment during the non-compete period. They call it consideration, but it's not the same as we view it here. It means that you must have a minimum level of payment for each month or the whole period of that non-compete. It can be 50% of salary, and including bonus. So Germany is like that. In some countries, it's included in the national collective agreement that applies in that country. France is an example of this. Italy, always the number one thing to check. And to also check, when does it have to be paid? Can you pay in advance? Can you claw back if the person violates? And also, what does it include? Does it include bonus? Does it include other benefits? That's the top thing to consider when you're thinking about a global reach non-compete. A lot of countries have a strict territorial limitation. And think about, you know, countries that are essentially an island. If you have the whole country as your territory, that person can't work in their homeland. So it's important to really check whether or not, like Louisiana, you have to define and limit it to a particular parish or certain city location. I want to point out one recent case in France, and this was a non-compete that was defined as a prohibition in the EEA, the European Economic Area, and France, including France. And the person went to go work in Switzerland. Well, Switzerland is not a member of the European Economic Area, and the French court invalidated as vis-a-vis Switzerland, said this is just not enforceable with regard to their activities because they are in Switzerland, and that is actually not included in your territorial scope of your non-compete. So very important drafting tip is to be specific with the territory, or, you know, I query whether the approach of European region might have worked better there rather than using a political designation or a really defined term. So just something to keep in mind. I want to point out another recent case, and this has to do with releasing the non-compete. There are a lot of countries that require specific time frames for releasing the non-compete. When you have to pay for a non-compete, it's easy to take the approach that, well, if we don't want to enforce it and pay that, we just want to enforce it. Well, a lot of countries, in addition to the payment requirements, say that if you are going to waive that non-compete obligation, you have to do it within a certain period of time after termination of employment or even before. In Germany, you have to do it, if you're going to release a non-compete, you have to give a year notice that you're going to waive the non-compete. So unless that year period ends when the employment's terminated, you're going to be paying for that non-compete. So I want to point out a case in the Czech Republic where an employer's unilateral decision to not enforce a non-compete, recent case law has said that this must have, you must have a legitimate reason if you're going to waive the non-compete. And it's, you know, query as to whether, you know, as to what a legitimate interest is when you're an employer not seeking to enforce a non-compete. However, another case came out and said that not only do you have to have a legitimate reason if you're not going to enforce the non-compete, this has to be in writing, and the reason has to be in writing in the non-compete. So, again, a drafting consideration, but gives you an idea of some of the issues you're going to encounter. The approach of, well, I'll just waive the non-compete if I don't want it, that's not going to work everywhere that you want it. So you have to plan in advance for that. And then a final note on some of the requirements. You have to look at the enforceability of the non-compete, and it may be tied to how the employee is terminated, whether they terminate or whether the employer terminates. For example, I'll just use Belgium as an example. If you terminate someone without notice, unless you have that cause to be able to terminate someone without notice, you're going to have a very hard time enforcing your non-compete. Same in the UK. If you breach the employment agreement by not terminating with the proper notice and it's found that you have breached the contract, you are not going to be able to enforce those contractual provisions. So it's very important at the time of separation to make sure you are not undoing all that hard work with your great non-compete that you've crafted to be valid in a number of jurisdictions. So just as we close out, when you're thinking about this non-compete that you're drafting to take into account potentially several jurisdictions, consider whether or not one of the requirements is that it be in the local language. Some jurisdictions will not enforce a non-compete unless it's signed in the local language. Belgium, for example, you need to sign those agreements in a particular language, and it may be French, it may be Dutch, it may be English if you live in a particular part of Belgium, but it has to be signed in that language. It's not okay just to have it translated and submitted to the court. In the payment, as we talked about a payment provision, again, make sure you are clearly defining what it is that you're paying the employee and what it's based on. If you have to pay 35% of their global monthly salary, this is significant and means something. It can mean their bonuses. It can mean their benefits. Make sure you know in advance and clearly indicate this in the provision. Again, also keep in mind, this is again France and Italy similarly, look at the collective bargaining agreement. Understand what the collective bargaining agreement requires. Some collective bargaining agreements don't specify how much it is. Some do, and it can be as high as 40%. So make sure you are complying with those requirements. And again, looking ahead to an employee who's in the U.S., who may go to France, well, are they under a collective agreement? No, they're not under a collective agreement, but what is the industry? And that will give you a good indication of what an appropriate compensation would be. And again, preparing the release for a non-compete, don't forget to put in that clause where you can release yourself from the non-compete, particularly if you have an obligation to pay. Make sure it's within the time limits that are required, and make sure, like in the Czech Republic, if you have to include reasons, put them in there. And then one final note, liquidated damages outside the U.S. are very common, so it does not preclude your ability to get injunctive relief in these countries, but consider that you may want to impose a liquidated damages provision, because in the end that might be the faster, more effective way to have some leverage over the employee. So I want to send it back to Robert to talk about our hypothetical situation of our employee who wants to shake off the non-compete in California.
Thanks, Marjorie. Great presentation and summary there. Yeah, with respect to our hypothetical, I wanted to follow up with you on this as a potential option for this former employer of a multinational employer who just lost a key executive to another multinational employer who they both do business in Germany, and the former employee, you know, lived and worked in Germany but serviced the company globally and then moves to California. you had mentioned that, you know, don't lose all hope if that you may want to file suit in Germany, and you may, if the employee still has connections to Germany, you may be able to get a money judgment. But what about what about some leverage against the new employer, considering that they do business in Germany? Do you think there may be some viability there through some sort of tortious interference with the non-compete type claim?
Sure. You know, anti-competitive activity, you know, the German courts do have an interest in preventing anti-competitive activity. And, you know, a cause of action where that company located in Germany or with a business interest in Germany, they have jurisdiction, and that company is found to interfere or, again, misappropriation and be involved in that, then, you know, that German court can take action against that company. So you're right. Don't underestimate the ability to go after the employer that's helping this employee avoid the non-compete.
Great. Yeah, and what I would say from a California perspective is, While I would not believe that a California court would honor necessarily an injunction from a German court enjoining the employee from working for a competitor in California, I wouldn't expect that to occur. But what I could see occurring is the, especially in light of the recent budget cuts in California as far as the courts go, I could definitely see if there was a forum selection provision, the California court either staying or dismissing a California declaratory relief claim. And that's also not to underestimate the being able to pursue some sort of a trade secret claim against the employee in California. But anyway, just wanted to let everybody know that if you didn't hear the CLE credit number, it's SS9215. And we did have one good question that I wanted to send over to Matt, and it had to do on his ITC presentation. And the question was essentially, would the ITC action apply to software, or does it only apply to in the Tian Rui case, these wheels, these products in that concept? Would it apply to software? Would you be able to get an order that would prohibit software from being sent into the United States?
Yeah, and I can answer that question briefly. In a traditional case, in a traditional case where the articles are tangible, customs is presented with a set of instructions on what to inspect and look for. The articles are screened based on the tariff schedule. There are thousands and thousands of different tariff schedule codes, and they're specific to any type of product you can imagine. And so they screen on that, and they can see the importation form, the port of entry, the country of origin, etc. Also, in some of those cases, a competitor may start seeing the products appear on store shelves, etc., and they'll contact their attorneys who go back to the ITC to initiate an enforcement proceeding. Back to the tangible item question, I recall there is a case where one of the articles subject to relief was not a traditional tangible item. I believe there was at least a cease and desist order covered the electronic submission of certain firmware files. And again, it's not subject, the customs wouldn't be able to detect it per se, but there are other methods of detecting it, such as by the private parties might see these items coming across and they know that the secret firmware is being used. So again, that was subject to relief. Anybody on the call can feel free to email me. This is Matt again, and I can respond and send around the case information if this is interesting to you.
Great. Thanks, Matt. And we also will direct you to our well, thanks everyone for participating today and taking part in our webinar. We weren't able to get into a discussion on a Vance Food case that was referenced in the PowerPoint. That's an interesting new case that deals with the interplay between California law and Irish law and a cross international dispute regarding trade secrets and a non-disclosure agreement, but you can get more information on that case at our trade secret blog, www.tradesecretslaw.com. Also, just to let you know, next month we will be having our sixth webinar of this year. It'll be on Georgia's non-compete statute. The statute's been on the books for almost a year now, and we wanted to bring you up to speed on some of the new cases coming out construing that statute. Thanks again for your time, and we hope to see you again.